Good evening, everybody. Venerable Children is traveling, and so she has asked the Abbey Monastics, as she did last week, to do a little bit of a meditation review on some of the topics that she's been teaching on the Easy Path. So last week, Venerable Jigme did a meditation and a little bit of sharing on how to rely on a spiritual mentor. And tonight we're going to do the meditation on the Buddha, and then a very nice, long, in-depth Lam Rim on the freedoms and fortunes of having a precious human life. And then I'll do a little bit of sharing some more of that evening's teachings that I have found very, very helpful in reviewing for tonight. And then we'll have a little bit of time for some Q&A. So we're going to begin, first of all, by doing our few minutes of breathing meditation wherever you are around the world, to give ourselves an opportunity to bring our bodies and minds into the space that we're going to be sharing tonight. And so we'll do that for a few moments, and then we'll go right into the meditation on the Buddha. So just use your breath as the object of your meditation, and as much as your mind turns away to the external environment around you, you gently bring it back without any judgment. If thoughts and feelings also arise, without any harshness, just bring your attention back to your breath. So imagine in your mind's eye, in the space in front of you, on a precious throne both high and wide, supported by 8 great lions, on a seat of a multicolored lotus, moon, sun disks, which represent the 3 principal aspects of the path, the determination to be free, bodhicitta, and the correct view, is our kind main spiritual mentor, in the form of the conqueror Shakyamuni Buddha. The color of his body is pure gold. On his head is the crown protuberance. He has 1 face and 2 hands. The right touches the earth. The left, in meditative posture, holds an alms bowl full of nectar. He wears the 3 saffron-colored robes of a monastic. His body, which is made of pure light, is adorned with the signs and marks of a Buddha and emanates a flood of light out into all the 10 directions. Sitting in Vajra posture, he is surrounded by all the direct and indirect spiritual mentors, by the deities, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, heroes, heroines, and a vast assembly of Arya Dharma protectors. In front of him on exquisite stands are his teachings in the form of books of light. The members of the merit field look upon all of us with great compassion, and in turn at the thought of their compassion and virtue, we have great faith in them. Really take that visualization, try to make it as clear and as close to your heart as possible. Make it as real as you can in your mind's eye. Really getting a sense that you're in the presence of these incredibly kind, wise, holy beings. And by garnering this faith and confidence in their ability to guide and inspire us, we become much more receptive and open to the teachings. Let's really cultivate that mind of faith and confidence in their wisdom, their loving compassion. And imagine yourself also surrounded by all mother sentient beings in human form. You can think of your mom and dad on either side of you, your friends, family, difficult ones between you and the merit field, and then countless mother sentient beings out into the limitless expanse of space. So we'll do our recitations. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, and present clouds of every type of offering, actual and mentally transformed. I confess all my destructive actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the virtues of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until cyclic existence ends, and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. I dedicate all the virtues of others to the great awakening. This ground anointed with perfume, flower-strewn Mount Meru, full and sun and moon, imagined as a Buddha land and offered to you, may all beings enjoy this pure land. The objects of attachment, aversion, and ignorance, friends, enemies, and strangers, my body, wealth, and enjoyments, I offer these without any sense of loss. Please accept them with pleasure and inspire me and others to be free from the three poisonous attitudes. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryatayami. And then imagine that a replica of the Buddha comes to the crown of your head. It's becoming being an advocate for requesting that the entire line of spiritual mentors, from him all the way down to our present teachers, to request that they remain and teach and inspire us to learn the Dharma and to practice. So imagine him on the crown of your head, representing all the spiritual mentors of all times. Glorious and precious Root Guru, sit upon the lotus and moon seat on my crown, guiding me with your great kindness. Bestow upon me the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. The eyes through whom the vast scriptures are seen, supreme doors for the fortunate who would cross over to spiritual freedom, illuminators whose wise means vibrate with compassion, to the entire line of spiritual mentors I make request. And then as we do the Buddha's mantra, 21 times, you really imagine that this Buddha on the crown of our head is pouring and streaming all this incredible light, wisdom, compassion, down through the crown of our heads and the heads of all beings surrounding us. Really helping to purify any destructive actions, any obstacles that get in the way of our practice, as well as blessing and inspiring our minds. Dayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muniye Soha. 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 And then we reflect the fact that I and all other sentient beings have been born in samsara and are endlessly subjected to intense dukkha due to our having failed to attain a superior realization of the great potential of freedom and fortune and of the difficulty of attaining them. Guru Buddha, please inspire me and all sentient beings so that we may attain a superior realization of the great potential of freedom and fortune and of the difficulty of attaining them. And then while reconnecting with the Guru Buddha on the crown of your head, we reflect further. The opportunity to practice the perfect teaching is called freedom. The presence of all inner and outer favorable conditions for spiritual practice is called fortune. In brief, the life with freedom and fortune that we have attained carries great potential, because on its basis we can produce the causes of a high rebirth with an excellent body and resources, generosity, ethical conduct, fortitude, and so forth. In particular, on its basis, we can generate the three kinds of ethical conduct, and in a short life of this degenerate age, easily accomplish Buddhahood. May I not waste in useless activities this life complete with freedom and fortune that is difficult to attain and carries great potential. And instead, may I take full advantage of it. Guru Deity, please inspire me to be able to do so. So in response to your requesting, the Guru Buddha, five colored light and nectar stream from all parts of his body into you through the crown of your head. It absorbs into your mind and body and those of all the sentient beings around you, purifying all negativities and obscurations accumulated since beginningless time, and especially purifying all illnesses, interferences, negativities, and obscurations that interfere with attaining a superior realization of the great potential of freedom and fortune. Your body becomes translucent, the nature of light. All your good qualities, lifespan, merit, and so forth expand and increase. Think in particular that a superior realization of the great potential of freedom and fortune has arisen in your mind stream and in the mind streams of others. Really concentrate on this visualization and on being able to think like this in regard to your relationship to the Guru Buddha, to the power of the light and nectar pouring down through the crown of your head, and really imagine it purifying all the things, all the obstacles that get in the way of each of us deeply realizing how rare and fortunate these freedoms and fortunes are to attain, and that by having a direct realization of them, it will completely transform our Dharma practice into one that is totally committed, sincere, consistent, filled with joy, filled with determination, fortitude, all the qualities that we need to progress along the path. And imagine your body filling with the light of these realizations, and imagine that happening. in order to be able to really take this beautiful topic of precious human life to heart a little more deeply tonight, we'll do the Lam Rim on the Eight Freedoms and Fortunes, spending some time on each point to really imagine each one of them deeply on how they affect our lives, being free of the unfortunate states, and then having the great fortune of all the conducive circumstances to be able to practice this life. So the eight freedoms, the first four are freedoms from non-human states. Once again, because we don't see many of the unfortunate realms, we need to use our imagination and do the best we can. The first one is a freedom from being born as a hell being. We all know that kind of mind that is overwhelmed by intense physical and mental suffering and is consumed by anger, hatred, hostility, rage. So having this precious human life, we are free from this unfortunate rebirth. So imagine if you were to be born in a situation where you had such intense physical and mental suffering, how very difficult it would be to be able to practice, to even think clearly. Try to imagine what it would be like to have that kind of suffering, and a mind that was so outraged all the time. And then by having this precious human life, we are free from being born as a hungry ghost. We all kind of know what that mind is like, consumed by craving and intense dissatisfaction. And having a body consumed by hunger and thirst. So imagine having that kind of life. What opportunity would we be able to practice the Dharma? Seeking, craving, intense dissatisfaction, never satisfied. And then we're free from being born as an animal. So even if we can't think about the hell and hungry ghost realms because we can't see them, we can see the suffering of the animal realm. This continual vigilance and efforting trying to stay alive and not get eaten. Continually moving, continually seeking to, looking for food, protecting your young, mating, running for your life. No time to turn to the Dharma. But you don't even have the intelligence to hear and understand it. So think of the animals of our world. Domesticated, enslaved. Living in the wilds of the world. Continually struggling to stay alive. No matter how small, no matter how big. And we're free of this. But just imagine what it would be like. To be a deer. To be a bumblebee. To be a dolphin in the ocean. Or a crab. Be a domesticated cow in Asia. Or a pig in America. And then the fourth of the non-human states that we are free from being born as is a long life god, which includes the gods of the desire, the form, and the formless realms. And although it may appear that they've got a lot going for them in that rebirth, they are so into their own bliss of samadhi, their own sense pleasures, that they're just too spaced out and indifferent to practice. There's no need, there's no desire, there's no wanting to practice. Just imagine having that kind of life where you have so much beauty and delight and bliss that you could care less about the Buddha's teachings. And then the second group of four are human states that we are free of. So we have our human life, and we're free of these. The first one is being born in what they call a barbaric land, which is born in a society that has no regard for spiritual practice, may even outlaw it, or outlaw any kind but one kind. Where there is war and constant threat. So we know of a lot of places in our world right now that have this difficulty. No religious freedom. Their lives are threatened if they try to practice the Dharma. So we're free of this state. We can practice anywhere, at any time. So what would it be like to not have that freedom? We are also free of being born where a Buddha has not appeared, or has appeared but didn't teach. So even those human beings living in our world prior to the birth of the Buddha didn't have the Dharma in the world. So what would it be like to live in a world that didn't have the Buddha's teachings? We are free of being born disabled, either physically or mentally. Back in the time of ancient India, being born deaf, dumb, or blind was very, very, a very big issue. People didn't have the kind of support and access to training and education and support like they do now. But we are free of any type of physical disability, or any kind of mental disability that really makes it difficult to understand the Dharma. So this is something we really take for granted a lot, at least I do. So think about being free of having any kind of physical and mental handicap. Even though there are a lot of physically, mentally disabled people who have made courageous efforts to practice, it really does become a big obstacle. And here we are with all of our wits about us. Just imagine what it would be like not to be able to think or maneuver the body, even just to get up out of bed. And then the last of the freedoms that we have are that we are free from having wrong views. That you can be academically brilliant, have a PhD, be a prominent scholar, and have lots of wrong views. Belief in a permanent soul, a belief that your actions have no ethical dimension to them. Believing that killing others brings a reward, some sort of spiritual reward. And making a lot of money through unethical practices, disregarding how that affects others. So we are free from those. No integrity. So then we think about the 10 fortunes that we have, which are 5 personal fortunes or conducive conditions, and 5 factors from society. So the first 5 are personal, first of all, being born human. Amazing. Just connect with that. That being born in a central land or a main Buddhist land, where there is, according to the Vinaya, there is a 4-fold assembly, fully ordained monks and nuns, male and female lay practitioners who have taken refuge and keep the 5 precepts. or according to the Mahayana Buddhism, where the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and the Prajnaparamita scriptures abide, and where there is the ability to receive teachings. Really get a sense of how rare that is, and what a great fortune that is, to have access, to have the fourfold Sangha. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in our world, the great Prajnaparamita. Totally open and accessible. And then, even if we had the fourfold Sangha, we had all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and the Prajnaparamita scriptures and accessibility and ability to receive the teachings, if we don't have complete faculties, if we aren't of sound body and mind, it wouldn't even be worth it. We wouldn't even know. We have the great fortune of not having committed the five heinous actions, killing our mother, father, an arhat, drawing blood from a Buddha, causing schism in the Sangha. We don't even have those things enter our minds, hopefully. Those actions propel one to a very, very deeply suffering rebirth. So to have the great fortune of not having that kind of motivations, And then think about the great fortune of having this kind of instinctual belief in the Buddha's teachings, that they are worthy of respect, that we're very receptive to hearing about ethical conduct, how important it is as the foundation of our practice, that we've got some faith or understanding in rebirth, that awakening is possible, belief in karma. Because if we didn't have the receptivity and this instinctive belief, we could live right in the middle of the most beautiful Buddhist land, have access to all the Dharma, have teachers living nearby, and have no interest whatsoever. Or have a kind of mind that's cynical, deluded, doubt. So the fact that we even navigate, you know, kind of draw to the Buddha's teachings with a kind of open-heartedness. And then the five factors from society sort of go together. They kind of build on one another. So we'll put them kind of together here. We live at a time where the Buddha has appeared, and even though he passed away 2,600 years ago, we have these remarkable spiritual mentors that teach the Dharma to us. And that the Buddha that has appeared on this earth 2,600 years ago not only taught sutra but tantra as well. That in this fortunate eon in which we dwell right now, where there will be 1,000 Buddhas, only 4 of them will teach tantra. So we have been born at a time when one of the Buddhas did come to our world and teach both sutra and tantra. And that the Dharma is stable and flourishing. Which has different meanings. Means where there is a transmitted Dharma or a scriptural Dharma passed down from teacher to student, so we can read and listen to them. So we have books, scriptures, passed down. Just think of how much we have access to online, in books, teachings on audio. And then it's also the insight dharma or the realizational dharma, which is the realizations gained from practicing the three higher trainings and the third and fourth noble truths. So this is the realizations that arise in the minds of the advanced practitioners of our time. So not only are they studying and thinking about the Dharma, but they are having direct realizations of it in their mind streams. And out of their great kindness, teach and inspire us to do the same. And finally, the last two of these five factors from society are that we live in a place where they're Sangha living and embodying the Buddha's teachings and doing their best to practice. We have these wonderful teachers, spiritual mentors, who have spent their whole lives practicing and now support us and inspire us. And we're born near people who value what we're doing and support us as well, so we have very supportive Dharma communities. For those of us who are monastics, we have wonderful, kind benefactors who supply the four requisites of food, shelter, medicine, and clothing. And we all have teachers and have all the conducive conditions to practice. And so when we do this lamrim on the freedoms and fortunes of a precious human life, we want to have, and if we've done it sincerely and really contemplated them, this feeling in our mind will arise. Almost like a homeless person finding a winning lottery ticket on the sidewalk. Even better than that, beyond worldly success, beyond worldly wealth, is to get this feeling of intense gratitude, intense almost wonder. So see if you can generate that in your mind and heart right now after thinking about all of these. This is a lot we have going for us. See if you can generate this deep sense of wonder and deep gratitude for all the things you have going for you with this precious human life. And try to hold that in your mind. Focus your mind and attention on that feeling. With this meditation, if we get that feeling, there's no room for discouragement or disappointment or depression or complaining. And then for the little bit of time that we have left, imagine that Buddha that's in the space in front of you, coming to the crown of your head and absorbing into the Buddha on the crown of your head, melting into light, reappearing at your heart. And just keep him there as we finish up this evening with a few more wonderful points about this precious human life of ours. Really imagine him at your heart, helping to inspire you to get a whole lot of clarity about the this wonderful, precious human life. So hopefully that has stirred up some nourishment in your mind for practice. I use this meditation a lot when I'm feeling, discouraged. I'm feeling like I don't have enough time, I don't have enough intelligence, I don't have enough determination, I've got this, I've got that. It's a really wonderful antidote for the mind of discouragement and the mind of scarcity and things like that. And the more frequently we do this meditation, the more it really freshens our mind and keeps our practice strong. Like, this is one of my favorite ones. So for just a few more minutes here, I wanted to, before we can get to some comments and Q&A, the night that Venerable taught this, the Freedoms and Fourths, and she included the great Tibetan teacher Longchenpa, added another 16 conditions. So if you think that you're doing pretty good because you've got all the 18 freedoms and fortunes, he's got another 16 here that can become serious obstacles in meditation or during the break time that can destroy one or more of the 8 freedoms and fortunes if we're not careful. So I wanted to go over these quickly because these are the ones that we have to keep an eye on. A lot of them are mental states and things that we really have to pay attention to. So I want to go over these quickly before we do. So the first 8 are called intrusive conditions. Okay, you can almost get an idea what they're going to look like. And then the other 8 are the incompatible propensities. So something about our internal process or the way that we think that gets in the way of our practice. Okay, so the first one of the intrusive conditions are the turmoil from 5 main afflictions: attachment, anger, confusion, pride, and jealousy. Who doesn't have this experience of having one of those going on in our minds where we can't think? You know, in meditation session, we're proliferating and thinking about them, and during the break session, we're creating them, or we're being under their control. So this is a huge obstacle to practice. Okay, so turmoil. Second, I kind of get a little huffy about this, but stupidity, which is the lack of intelligence. This, when I thought of this, when I think about the 3 analogies of the pot, you know, the pot that's upside down, the pot that's right side up but has a leak in it, or the pot that has very dirty, filthy material in it. So we just can't understand the teachings for whatever reason. We've got something in the way. So that's the lack of this kind of Dharma intelligence, this kind of brightness and clarity. 3 is dominated by bad friends that take you away from the Dharma. So once again, they're not bad friends in that they're mean and deceptive and dishonest and steal and kill. They're the kind of folks with your best intentions at heart. They just pull you away from the Dharma. They would rather have you participate with them in a lot of 8 worldly concerns and doing things other than practicing. And, you know, we have those in our, we have a lot of folks like that in our life that don't resonate to what we're doing and think we're kind of crazy or we're spending too much time and they want us to do other things with them. So that's a thing that can get in the way of our practice. Laziness, either the sloth kind, the manana mentality kind, or the discouragement kind. 5 is inundated by the effects of past negative karma. So this is how Venerable describes this. This is a common occurrence, at least for me. Due to the backlog of past negative karma, which is so strong that despite efforts put into our practice, our minds are very obscured and very hard to develop our good qualities. So they're continually, our negative karma is continually ripening, distracting us, making our minds foggy and sleepy and unclear and resistant and resentful. this is all just all this negative karma that just keeps ripening if we give it some room to generate and come up. And that's, you know, not having our mindfulness and our introspective awareness. This is when this can really happen. And she says another way that it can happen is that we lose confidence, not because of the negative actions, but because we think the Dharma isn't working. So we start running up against teachings that are difficult to understand, or our meditation becomes kind of dry and rote. We don't question that maybe it's just negative karma ripening. We think that there's something wrong with the Dharma, which can be a huge obstacle. We start doubting the power of our practice. Number six is called enslaved by others. We have no autonomy. So we may not be enslaved like they were in, you know, olden times, but let's say we have a deep connection to the Dharma and our spouse or family member just has a fit anytime we want to go on retreat, anytime we want to take a weekend and go up and either go to a center or receive teachings or do some online teachings. They just get really upset and angry and start, you know, pressuring us. And so we don't feel like we have any space or any respect to really be able to cultivate our spiritual path. Then number seven is seeking protection and support with the wrong motivation. So this is from lacking food and shelter. We practice in order to get these things. We don't have a deep connection and a sincere motivation, but we're looking for others to take care of us. So we go to the centers, we come to the abbey just thinking that it's all going to be hunky-dory and that people are going to feed us and we're going to have a roof over our heads. So it's kind of like trying to take a major shortcut on how to become awakened is to let other people do most of the work for us. So we're seeking, it has a wrong motivation. We're not practicing purely. And then number eight is hypocritical. We assume a very humble, calm, compassionate demeanor, but inside we are being propelled by the eight worldly concerns. So this is something that happens, especially, well, we practice the Dharma, sort of. We may put on a really good show on the outside, but when it comes on the inside, we're quite reckless. We're not really taking care of seeing how the eight worldly concerns can really drive a lot of why we do what we do. Even our practice, the eight worldly concerns can drive our practice, which means it stops becoming Dharma practice and it starts becoming worldly concern practice. Okay, so those are the eight, what are they called again? Intrusive conditions. And then we've got the eight incompatible propensities. Number nine, or number the one of this one, this set, is bound by worldly commitments. Okay, so this is the laziness of busyness, no time to practice because we have obligations. And this one, I think for a lot of our friends, our lay friends, there's a lot of family commitments. You know, you've got kids, you've got baseball games and hockey games and music lessons, you've got hobby, social engagement, work responsibilities. And so the things just keeping our lives together get to be a major obstacle to practice because it takes time to practice and it takes a lot of time to keep weekly dinners with family and work responsibilities. So they really, we feel bound, we feel obligated, and so practice suffers. Number 10 is called flagrant depravity. This is destructive behavior, values that are not in line with basic human kindness. We have no concern for anyone else. This is just a pretty destructive, ill-behaved human being. It was just really not tracking well on any level. Number 11, this is one we have to be really careful of too, lack of dissatisfaction about samsara. So we have, when we think about the disadvantages of samsara or karma or unfortunate rebirths, it doesn't like turn our minds or energize our minds to practice the three principal aspects of the path. So we don't find ourselves shifting when we think about these things. We want to tweak samsara, which is pretty good right now. So why change things? So we don't have a lot of energy to practice because we're not dissatisfied, we're not disenchanted with samsara enough. So we just keep going along, creating the cause and conditions to yet again continue cycling in samsara. Number 12, absence of faith in the teachings or your teacher. We don't follow their instructions. We want things to happen by simply wishing them, not by actually coming to our practice with joyous effort. So once again, this is one of those too much trouble, too much work, too much effort. Number 13, taking pleasure in non-virtuous action. So this is drinking, unwise sexual behavior, smoking pot, gambling, fishing, hunting, things that were really creating a lot of destructive karma, which will become huge obstacles to our practice not only now, but in the future. Lack of interest in the Dharma, boring. We actually think the Dharma is boring. We'd rather go to the movies, we'd rather take a nap, we'd rather just hang out with friends and just talk about, you know, who's doing what. We'd rather just squander our time. We're bored. Number 15, we are heedless of precepts. We have no introspective awareness. We have no integrity or care about keeping our precepts. We're very sloppy about them. You know, that's that slippery slope where we justify and talk ourselves out of keeping them well, or we conceal them. So we're really heedless about how important they are in protecting our minds, be able to create the causes and conditions to have a precious human life in the future, because ethical conduct is one of the main substantial conditions to have a precious human life. And by being heedless with our precepts, we are not creating those causes whatsoever. And then the last one is being neglectful of our samaya, which is being disrespectful of those of us who have taken tantric empowerments, not keeping them or keeping our commitment to practice, which is very serious, serious destructive karma that we're creating. So on top of all of the freedoms and fortunes that we have, we need to be very, very careful about these propensities and these conditions that can really get in the way, and as it says, which can destroy one or more of the 18 freedoms and fortunes. So we've got the 18 freedoms and fortunes, and if we're not careful with these 16, we're going to lose them. So that's a lot to chew on, and really brings our practice to life if we do take them to heart. And so the teachings on this are online if you want to really be, you know, hear Venerable teach on them again. And so we've got a few minutes here. I want to know if there's any comments or any questions that some folks may have about this precious human life of ours. So one of the things that we have to really remember is that even though there are 7 billion human beings on this planet, they do not all have precious human lives. You can be a human being and have a long human life, but it won't be a precious one because you don't have these freedoms and fortunes. So it's very helpful to understand that. It's a very, very rare and precious rebirth.
There's a comment from Howard saying that the teaching goes perfect with the SAFE program this week. Thank you.
Okay, so you get to use a little bit more fuel for the practice. Yeah. Because one of the things about this precious human life is the first Lamrim topic on the initial scope. And I think it's very important that when we first come to the Dharma, and even in the middle and later on in the path, is that we continually have to remind ourselves that this is not a given. You know, that having these freedoms and fortunes is not an entitlement. It doesn't come with the human life. That through incredible amounts of previous virtuous karma, which we will talk about in the next week on how rare this is and what the cause and conditions are. But to always remember that this is not, it's so hard to not get complacent about it, to think that this is something that's normal, something that's common, something that's everyday. But that is really quite precious.
Here's a question from Jim. How do you ride through the negative karma that is ripening all the time?
Okay, well, okay, so there's someone asking a question that says, well, how do you, when the negative karma is ripening, which it happens during the course of the day in small ways and big ways, how do you ride that through? Well, there's a number of ways of looking at it. First of all, purification practice done on a daily basis will attenuate the the depth and the seriousness of the negative karma. Okay, so it'll bring it down so that when the negative karma does ripen, it comes as a small suffering rather than as a great suffering. The second one is that we've got to wrap our minds around the idea that when negative karma is ripening, once it's done, it's finished. And that what we want to do, if we don't want to experience that type of karma in the future, is that we actually have got to get our minds to rejoice when that happens. It's ripening. I'm right in the middle of a really difficult circumstance. There's a problem arising. I'm not feeling well. Something's coming up that's most difficult. This is the result of my negative karma. I'm glad it's ripening now and not some wild, unfortunate rebirth where the suffering would be a whole lot worse. So we've got to wrap our minds around when the karma is ripening, it will finish because it is an impermanent phenomena, and that once it finishes, our relationship to that ripening determines whether we're going to be creating the causes for it to happen in the future or whether it's done. So bringing a kind of fortitude, a kind of willingness to bear it with fortitude, with a kind of a clear, open heart, and to continue to purify. Once that's done, it's done. You know, let it go. And as you're writing it out, you've got to bring your mind back to the fact that this is something that we have created ourselves. It's not being caused from some external circumstance. That this is something that we have caused ourselves. And if we don't want to have it happen again, we do have some control over that. So those are some of the ways that I use personally when these things are happening in my life.
There's a question from Jolene. How do we overcome the pain and aching during long meditation?
Well, my experience is... Oh, how do you overcome the physical and the mental?
The physical pain and aching of long meditation sessions.
Well, my experience is that unless you do meditation practice on a consistent daily basis, there's a point where when you get to that level of discomfort, if you stop, that's as far as you're going to get. That the consistency of daily practice, making sure that your position is correct, and when the sensations of discomfort and pain arise, to be able to hold those sensations as just that. If you start trying to twitch and start trying to move just a little bit to ease that discomfort, you're going to start perpetuating. You're going to have to move a little bit again in a few more seconds, and you're going to move a little more frequently. And after a while, it's going to be very, very hard to find any type of focus. So it's a matter of a consistent daily practice, because the body does need that to get used to sitting in that position. The position needs to be correct, and to see the sensations that arise as just that. To try to not get into going, uh-oh, my knee's starting to hurt. Oh my gosh, I don't know what I should do about that. You know, to try to get the mind talking about the discomfort and seeing if you can just ride that discomfort out. Because many times, at least for me, if I don't put a lot of dialogue on what I think is happening, that it actually subsides. And at some point, if it's just really disrupting your meditation, then just call it good. You know, but you want to end your meditation with a kind of joy and a sense of garner some benefit. You don't want to come out of it in total, complete pain. So you've got to balance the discomfort, trying to work your consistency to where you can work through that discomfort, but to not end the session in that kind of physical discomfort, because then you're going to be really resistant to coming and showing up the next morning. So there's a fine balance. But the more you do it consistently, that physical pain does go away. But it does really do.
And another question from Jolene. If you find jealousy causing you anger, how can you use meditation to overcome it?
Well, first of all... If you have jealousy that arises in your mind, and then as a result of that jealousy you get really, really angry, what kind of meditation will help with that? Well, first of all, when I get jealous... Well, first of all, we're comparing ourselves, okay? So there's this sense of, I don't have The lack of contentment, first of all, is usually a big sign that jealousy is going to arise. We're comparing ourselves. Anytime we have a comparing, judging mind, where we're putting our life, our qualities, our capabilities, our opportunities, and comparing them to somebody else, it's a no-win situation. Okay, so I would try to work with the jealousy in the beginning so you're not getting into the anger. Jealousy is actually a form of anger, because then the dialogue about they've got it, they're so lucky, why don't I have it, I wish that I deserve it. You've got to really avert that comparing mind as soon as it starts. Right? You've got to be able to rejoice in what you have. You know, jealousy is a mind that doesn't see the good things of life, doesn't see the good qualities that we have, and only looks outward in this comparing, judging mind. So I would try, as soon as that comes up, Jolene, I would really try to avert that by looking at the good things in your life. I mean, when I see your life, knowing you, it's a remarkable life. And so for you to be, even if you have to write them down, Jolene has, and write them down, all the qualities, the conditions, look at those freedoms and fortunes, and see if you've got all of them. And then you look at what that person has and you rejoice. They have created the causes for that fortune. They have earned it. They have created the causes. And see if you can work into being happy for them rather than being jealous. And if you get into the angry place, well, come back to saying, I need to create the causes. If I want those things, I need to create the causes for them myself. So hopefully that helps. Maybe one more.
Even you know samsara, but you are still not motivated to practice, what should you do?
Well, I would say that you don't know samsara. If we understand the disadvantages of creating the karma that keeps us cycling in birth, aging, sickness, and death over and over again, that this entire cycle is transitory, it is by its very nature unsatisfactory, and has absolutely nothing solid or tangible to hold on to. You have to go over those contemplations over and over again and see how they apply in your life. Because I can't hear that. I don't believe that that's true. If you look at the disadvantages of samsara and you still can't grow your determination to be free, then you've got to go back to your practice and see someplace you're missing that. Can you give me the question one more time, Venerable Digme?
Even you know samsara, but you are still not motivated to practice, what should you do?
Yeah. If you know samsara, you would do, as they say, practice like your hair was on fire. So I would go once again, go back to looking at that middle scope of the Lam Rim. Look at those sufferings of the different realms. Look at the disadvantages of cyclic existence. Look at the three characteristics of cyclic existence. Because if we know samsara, you're going to be extremely motivated. And it takes time. Samsara is extremely, it's a low-grade happiness that we have been hooked into, addicted to, since beginningless life. But we've got to be able to see its characteristics and that it does not supply any lasting happiness. So go back to that middle scope and really look at those deeply and see how they apply to your life and see if that helps. That should be able to generate some energy and some enthusiasm for your practice. Yeah. Keep trying. Don't give up. But don't let samsara fool you. Okay. So let's take a moment to just sit and rejoice that we can share with each other, talk with each other, that we have this precious human life, that we have created the causes for it, and by practicing the Dharma this life with sincere motivation, a bodhicitta motivation, that we will be able to create the causes to have many of them in the future. So let's rejoice at our time together. dedicate. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Bodhisattva's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Pure Supreme Spiritual Leader, Omniscient King of the Shakyas, Motherly Tara, Supreme Bestower of Longevity and Wisdom, Vast Ocean Assembly of Sources of Refuge, grant propitiousness here and now for a nectar of benefit and bliss to flow. With the clear mind of extensive learning gained from following the wondrous traditions of Thupten, the Able One's teachings, bring clarity to masses of disciples with the light of children, the lamp of the Dharma. May your lotus feet remain unfaltering for a very long time. Through your dharmic deeds of hearing, thinking, meditating, and so on, place those who seek the liberated path in harmony through immaculate discipline. Please lead all beings to liberation with undeclining excellent qualities of scripture and insight, and establish them in the glory of eternal bliss. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Travasti Abbey in the West, flourish.